And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Seth Arnes.
And now joining us is chemical biologist, conservation leader, and National Geographic explorer, Dr. Rosa Vasquez Espinoza. Dr. Espinoza has a deep knowledge of the Amazon and has been leading a global movement in protecting its wild pollinators. She has also penned a new book titled The Spirit of the Rainforest. Thank you so much for joining us on This Green Earth, Dr. Espinoza.
Thank you so much for the invite. It's a great pleasure to join you today.
We want to start this off by learning a little bit more about you and your background and what led you here. You have a really incredible upbringing that has brought you a lot of knowledge, and then you went into this field as a biologist. So can you take us on your journey to becoming a Nat Geo explorer and a defender of the Amazon?
Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. I'm Peru born, and I did my scientific studies in the US, but my entire childhood, I had a deep connection with indigenous cosmovisions and worldviews. My grandmother is a traditional healer from the mountains, and so I grew up having such a deep connection to these indigenous perspectives and being in love with nature by seeing my grandmother treat nature as a living being, plants, animals. And as I gained more interest in science, I realized that I was really navigating two worlds, one with modern Western scientific techniques and one with indigenous perspectives that haven't really been considered science, but that I think they are science on their own right. And this is something that's being more broadly recognized globally, even by institutions like UNESCO that I collaborate with extensively. And so that led me to continue advanced science education in the US with a PhD in chemical biology. And in that process, I really wanted to go back to Peru and be able to serve my rainforest and serve my country with this dual perspective and using science to regenerate our forests and our life forms. That led me to become a National Geographic explorer when I started to conduct independent work. And well, it has now led to a series of incredible achievements and challenges as well. And we have an amazing team in Peru that together with us and indigenous leaders, we are collectively leading, I think, a new way of conducting science and regeneration in the Amazon.
Yes, and I am enthralled by the way you are looking at the world in bringing the value of this knowledge that has come from a true understanding of the natural world and bringing that into the academic. And you have said that the difference is only in the tools, not in the value of the knowledge. Can you expand on that thought?
Yeah, it's a beautiful way to put it. The difference is in the tools and in the path, but not in the value and what they bring forward. So indigenous people and communities have relied on nature for generations. Nature is where people, you know, got their medicines from, their foods from, resources, clothing. And really, in the largest span of evolution in our planet, that is how all of our ancestors survived on this planet, by having such a deep relationship with nature. That meant closely observing nature, coming up with questions, curiosity, testing things, reiterating that testing, and getting in a way to a hypothesis. And that knowledge has been transmitted primarily orally, at least in the Amazon rainforest. That really is the result of years of testing, except you are not testing it with machines and numbers and data, which is what modern science does. And so I think modern science has allowed us to have incredible advances, surgery, you know, advanced antibiotics. But in a way, I believe that we are doing a disservice to nature by not incorporating both knowledge systems. There's always been a sense of imbalance, and that power has not been equal. There's so many medicines today that continue to save millions of people's lives that have been inspired or obtained thanks to traditional knowledge, and yet that traditional knowledge has never been recognized or has been rewarded or even joined as a co-author in it. And so part of our my personal mission and the work we do is changing that, elevating indigenous and traditional knowledge to the same platform as where modern science is. And we're doing that by co-authoring with indigenous scientists, by giving them the opportunity to speak in academic spaces and holding larger conversations, including with the National Council of Science in Peru. We're actually developing right now a national plan as to how could this merging of knowledge happens and what would that mean as well for innovation.
Right. And we do risk a lot when we dismiss this centuries old knowledge and lived experience. And so where do you think some of those risks lie when we don't give voice to the people that have been practicing this for centuries?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll give you a very key example of what became the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2015 that was given thanks to the discovery of a medicine called artemisinin, an anti-malarial drug that has saved millions of people's lives. And the reason why the scientists were able to discover this from a plant was because they went back to read centuries-old writings from Chinese medicine, and they had a traditional knowledge had a different way of extracting this active component from the plants compared to what synthetic chemists have been trying to do for decades. So that discovery was only possible thanks to accessing this traditional knowledge. And so there are many things that we still need to do to get there. The way that we conduct science and think of innovation or even measure it has been really reliant on a single Western way of knowledge and thinking and acknowledging. And so I think right now there's a much larger conversation, us in South America, but also places like Canada and Australia that are really looking to integrate their traditional knowledge at multiple levels in science, in education, even in public awareness. And in my opinion, right now it's a rare thing to still see. I think it will become the norm. And when we do that, I think our efforts in nature regeneration are going to be much more accelerated.
So just expanding on that a little bit, we've talked generally about how indigenous ecological knowledge has been left out of science and can be helpful in science. Can you give some specific examples where your background in indigenous ecological knowledge and your training as a scientist, where you brought that indigenous knowledge into the science that you're doing, and then you've maybe discovered something that you wouldn't have if it weren't for paying attention to indigenous knowledge?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'll give you one example. With our team, we were able to generate the first evidence, scientific link between deforestation and native bee decline in the Amazonian forest. That was really key to get a lot of change done. And the only reason we were able to get that evidence was because we had that merge of knowledge. And I'll explain. Finding these native bees, they're stingless. It is really difficult to do. And the best or only way really to do it is by following indigenous methods of listening in the middle of the dark. And once you find the bee, following the indigenous methodology of the entry towards the hive and identifying that to a certain bee. That allowed us to be able to map them in real time without having to wait for genetic tests that are not even ready to this date, and being able to generate the data quickly enough to be able to present it to stakeholders and authorities. And so I think that indigenous way of identifying bees, I call it indigenous taxonomy, matched modern taxonomy quite beautifully. And so I think that is just one example of us being able to get this first evidence of deforestation leading to bee decline there. But there are so many others, the use of specific medicinal plants by certain animals, which was something that modern science is only starting to even acknowledge, that animals in the wild use natural medicines and know what medicines to go to. That's something by observation we have been seeing with traditional knowledge, and yet it had not been fully explored. So I think we're only at the tip of the iceberg here.
So a lot of attention when we think about the Amazon rainforest and how some of the plants and animals may be helpful to society, we think about the use of plants and medicines and pharmaceuticals. You yourself focus more of your work on studying microorganisms. What have you learned about microorganisms in the Amazon that may be potentially helpful to other efforts like conservation of rainforests or other applications in medicine or industry?
So my expertise began with microorganisms. We've definitely expanded to do that. We have a larger team now. So we are also looking at things like honey being an important medicine, as well as medicinal plants. So we definitely have a broad range of topics that we're covering. But I would say, you know, nature, microorganisms included, medicinal plants, soils, provide us with so many of the solutions that we need for challenges in our modern world, medicine being a key one. Like in the 1960s, the best, most efficient way for us to access antibiotics was by accessing microbes within soils, as well as fungi. And so over time, we started to rely back primarily on synthetic methods and the human mind, and we have been able to get to amazing advances. But there is something to say about nature is the perfect chemist. Nature is the perfect biologist. And in a way, our ancestral civilizations had found a way to communicate and work with nature in sustainable ways for construction, for agriculture, which is much older than we haven't even realized. For medicine, of course, for cosmetics, for materials. And so I think we've disregarded that for a long time. And I feel like ever so slowly but surely, there's now this desire globally to get a bit closer back to nature and to acknowledge, hey, maybe we don't know it all. Maybe all of our advances still have limitations. And I believe that that's the same when we talk about climate solutions.
Let's turn the spotlight on your book. The book is called The Spirit of the Rainforest, and you really do bring in the world of your grandmother and some of the ways in which she has passed knowledge on to you about nature's pharmacy, as you've been describing, and you carry that on with you today. Can you discuss why you thought it was important to bring this book to the world and what you are hoping that we as readers can gain from it?
Thank you. Yeah, my book called The Spirit of the Rainforest is really a look into a way of exploring the Amazon rainforest through a lens that perhaps many never ever get a chance to in a lifetime. I give a very adventurous perspective of real life cases and scenarios, a little bit of the science behind that, but definitely a traditional perspective as well. And I even begin each chapter with a pharmacopoeia note where I present a specific natural resource, a plant or Stingless bihani, and I give the scientific take on that, what is known chemically, biologically, ecologically, but also what does that mean traditionally? What are the ancestral practices or knowledge associated with it? And I think that is just a reflection of how I see the world. There are multiple motivations behind the book, the biggest one being that when I left Peru in the Amazon and the Andes, I realized that most of the stories being told about the Amazon rainforest were not being told by people born in these territories. I actually even find it hard to find a book that was written by Peruvians and Amazonians about the Amazon rainforest. And so I realized that most of the narrative was very one-sided. Was very men versus wild, me fighting the anaconda, the jaguar, when in reality, the Amazon has a whole other side to it. Yes, it is dangerous in certain scenarios, and it has this factor. But at the same time, there is a very maternal feeling, a very kind feeling of the rainforest. And this is reflected not just in practices, indigenous traditions, but in the wildlife that most people miss, like pink dolphins or caterpillars, or the largest freshwater fish in the world. And so I think with the book, I kind of bring that back as a way to rekindle wonder and also remind people that although there are these stories from the deep Amazon, we can really find wonder anywhere in nature around us. And ultimately, it's kind of giving ourselves permission to feel like a child again in nature, wherever you are in the world. Even if you have access to only a single tree, we can still find wonder in nature.
Yeah, and you did take us through some expeditions. Can you share with us some of maybe the more treacherous places that you went that, you know, most of us will never get to see, but you get to describe it from a very detailed level?
Yeah, one expedition is in the Boiling River, so most people have never even heard of. It is a river that is literally boiling, 99.1 Celsius to 100 Fahrenheit. You can boil an egg or cook a chicken or make tea in that temperature. and it is 4 miles long. It's quite wide, it's quite deep, and it's in the heart of the rainforest. Unlike places like Yellowstone, for example, where you do have hot spring systems, but they tend to not have flora thriving right immediately next to it. It's too hot, it's too acidic, it's too extreme. But in the Bolin River of the Amazon, nature has adapted. And so it kind of becomes a natural laboratory for climate change. And so I described some of the challenges we had there. You know, navigating these spaces is very dangerous. We did have a team member that got injured, and that kind of like led an insane amount of teamwork and indigenous support. I also described the first times we were doing evening expeditions and facing the most dangerous caterpillar in the world, but also getting to see glowing life, animals that glow in the dark but have never been reported scientifically in the Amazon. We're currently working on that with my team, but really kind of recognizing, we talk about exploration, discovery, sometimes now outside of the world, right? Outside of our planet Earth, in space, which is fascinating and really important research, but we forget there's still yet so much to discover here, right in our land below our feet.
We are also living in a time where it's amazing to me that you can still go to places that are unexplored or learned so much from, because we feel like we've covered so much of the planet, but there's still so much more to gain knowledge from. And I'm curious, when you're writing a book like this and it's hopeful and there's optimism, how you stay in that optimistic framework when we are looking at some of the destruction happening in the Amazon and some of the things that are happening that are ways in which we as humans might be even more destructive to our planet. How do you stay in that optimism?
Yeah, I mean, even the term climate anxiety, right? It has only been coined quite recently. And it is the biggest question I actually receive from youth. I get to connect with audiences around the world, all ages. But that is the number one question from youth, particularly, who are growing up with a different perspective and seeing all these disasters. It's not easy. I think it is a practice. But I think, to me, what gives me hope is seeing the people's faces in the Amazon. And although they are facing some of the worst impacts of climate change, although they have been the least to contribute to it, you know, soils have dried up, their water sources have dried up, they cannot fish anymore, they don't find food anymore, yet they are keen to try, and they are keen to do it with a smile and with joy, because they recognize that life is short, the same way that a flower thrives and flourishes and then it dies. They want to live in community because that's all that they know. That is how they have survived by generations. And that means being able to uplift your community and ensuring that at least your immediate surroundings are taking care of the best that you can. So I think getting to see the children and that spirit being carried over, it's just, to me, is what gives me hope, as well as seeing the perspectives that our youth are having globally, the interest to want to do something that matters and not just being driven by egocentric kind of desires, but really a sense of community. I think that is what we have lost in the Western world. We focus so much on individualism, and yet somehow that actually hasn't been the best for our planet globally. And so I get inspired by that. I think by reminding myself that nature is a beautiful and source of life, no matter where I am in the world, how cold it may get and it feels lifeless, I choose to find the beauty in the small pieces of nature that I'm around, even if that's looking at the stars in an evening. And so I think that sense is what I also look to transmit with the book, because that sense of disconnection of nature and that sense of hopelessness, in my opinion, is one of the biggest reasons why we are in the environmental crisis in which we find ourselves today.
I could follow up an optimistic question with a slightly more pessimistic question, but you sparked my interest. Now, can you tell me about a specific example in all of your travels, you know, recently in the Amazon doing research, where you've just had a moment where it's filled you with optimism, something you've seen in the natural world, something you've seen about how humans are interacting with the natural world? Have you had one of those just moments that seems really clear that, oh, there is hope?
Yes, quite recently. So we were in this expedition really deep in the southern Amazon in Peru, doing quite a lot of work with many teams. And we always like to do activities with the local youth and kids even if that means providing some papers and colors so that they can paint. And by the time we came back, we realized that all the kids had painted bees and thriving flowers. None of us, we were doing work on bees. We had not mentioned or asked the kids to draw bees, but all the kids were different ages, from 3 years old to 18 years old. They were talking about it. They all had painted bees as a way to bring their forest back. And to me, then you are looking at a generation that is going to look at things differently. We have heard from many Indigenous leaders that, you know, when they were much younger, there was a community that would cut down all the forests, and that's all they knew. But they started to talk to the children. And now, 20 years later, that community, those children are the adults that are running the community. They don't cut down the trees anymore. They are finding alternative ways of income through bees or through other resources that do not damage the forest. So to me, that is the latest, you know, very hopeful source of inspiration.
When we sit in optimism, I love that, looking at the next generation, and they're already finding solutions and they're natural solutions to some of the issues that we're facing in our world. When you see people pick up this book, if you had one takeaway that you would really want them to sit with, what would it be?
I would say to follow your questions. I think to follow our passion sometimes can feel so big, especially when the future feels so uncertain as it does right now. But if we follow our questions, it means we're following our curiosities. It means we're staying authentic to everything we bring into the table, to who we are and what we care about. And I think that makes for unique journeys. And I think by allowing ourselves that flexibility, we also remember that we all come from nature. And I think every child always enjoys spending time outside. And that's a good reminder for us as adults to do that too.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate you so much. We have been speaking with chemical biologist, conservation leader, and National Geographic explorer, Dr. Rosa Vasquez Espinoza, who has just written a book titled The Spirit of the Rainforest. If people wanted to pick up this book or learn more about you, do you have a website, and where can they go?
Yes, my website is rosavespinoza.com. You can find me in socials. I'm quite active as well as Rosa V. Espinoza. The book has is coming out in paperback in the U.S. or just came out. So it's in all libraries, online as well, really any preferred way. It's an audiobook as well, which I narrated myself. And it is coming out in Spanish at the end of this year too. So yeah, it's quite easy to find, and I look forward to hearing people's thoughts on it as well.
Well, fantastic. Well, we appreciate you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today, Dr. Espinoza. Thank you for being a part of our morning.
Thank you so much. Lovely to meet you guys.
Thank you for joining us.